Hey, everybody. Welcome to the new episode, nearing 100 episodes, any moment of Bob Saget's Here For You. I love doing this podcast so much. It gave me a reason to invite this gentleman over, who I get to say is a friend of mine. I know. I had friend issues as a kid, okay? It's not about name dropping. Some people just go, well, I've got, you know, this person, that person, and they name people that have the top five movies. I idolize certain people since I'm a kid. So I didn't know I'd be a stand-up. I didn't know, but I had an affinity for comedy. And one of the groups that was the biggest influence on my life was Monty Python. And I got to know this gentleman who is one of the most brilliant people that I've ever met in comedy, and it's Eric Idle, and he's my guest today. So those of you that might not know Gen Z, forget about it, but you can learn. You should try Gen X. Study up, see some movies, see Holy Grail, see Life of Brian, see Meaning of Life, go through the annals, of Monty Python, and then go through the history of Eric Idle, Spamalot on Broadway, a great writer. This is called Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. It's a sort of biography. That's what it is. And it's a really good book. I had the pleasure of doing the book talk for him here in Santa Monica, and he went and did it in England and Canada and Australia. It's a really good book, especially if you're a Python fan. They were undeniably kind of the Beatles of comedy, and George Harrison always wanted to meet Eric, and they became really dear friends, one of the best friends of each other's lives. And George Harrison made it possible for Life of Brian to get made. He financed it. So this is a really special podcast today of someone that I saw Holy Grail in a theater in Philadelphia when I was 17 or 18, and I couldn't believe what I'd seen. And we were all laughing out loud at the genius of these gentlemen. And I'd already seen them on television in Monty Python's Flying Circus. Some places they called it Flying Circus, some places they called it Monty Python. In any case, brilliant, brilliant men and women that put this together. This historic comedy troupe that will live forever. And if you're not familiar with them, I recommend right away Holy Grail, Meaning of Life, Life of Brian. I'm a musical comedy aficionado or wannabe. I'm a wannabe, and I do musical comedy in my work. I always have. And this gentleman wrote this song, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. Wrote a lot of songs, wrote the theme song for and sang for The Meaning of Life. He's a pretty brilliant man in many, many ways. And it's my pleasure right now to move into a man that's going to fill this chair, Eric Idle.
Who would you look at in your life and go, oh my God, I can't believe I got to sit and talk with them?
Well, quite a lot of people. Unlikely, unusual. I met the guy who discovered DNA.
Is that true?
Yeah. What were they
called? Did he discover it in the couch?
Well, not in just in the couch. He's got it in his trousers, but we were on holiday, so we had to get rid of it. But his name, Doctor, you know, he did the DNA. Those two, Crick and Watson, Dr. Watson,
right,
was his name, oddly
That's
enough.
Bizarre.
Yeah, no, and he was really funny. He's a really funny guy. And we had good fun, and he was very nice. My wife loved him too. So he was a good companion for dinner.
How did he? So he worked in a lab, and he was just trying to figure out how human beings.
Well, that was 1950s in Cambridge, and him and Crick, and there was a Rosie somebody from London University was also involved. I think they nicked her research, but they were trying to figure out the modeling shape of what DNA is, and they finally came up with it, and they made a double helix, and suddenly everything fitted. And that was the beginning of the genetic science, which now means we can we have the genetic code completely done.
Well, some people I don't think believe in that now.
There's no end to how many stupid people there are in the world, and that's quite normal, because how would you expect there to be more intelligent people than stupid?
Yeah.
Because it would be going the wrong way. So this is like, people are evolving, but slowly.
But if it was proportionally different, I think we'd be a much more peaceful society around the whole world, right?
Too many people to be peaceful. I think the interesting thing about COVID has been on lockdown, it was like being in the 18th century, and I actually quite enjoyed it, because you didn't have to go out.
Right.
Dress up every bloody night and think of something funny to say, or where are you going to have dinner? Or, you know, it's really nice. It was like the 18th century, and occasionally you'd hear news, and that was it.
You have the most wonderful wife.
Apparently, yes, I do. Actually, no, we celebrated our 40th wedding anniversary the other day, which was very, very, very much fun. And yeah, she's lovely. She's adorable.
She is, and she's beautiful.
That too.
You fell in love with her instantly. I remember you actually told me this at dinner.
She asked, I was in New York, and it was an after party for Saturday Night Live down in the Bowery. And she asked me to dance, which is asking for it, isn't it?
Right.
You know, and she got it. So now we've been together since that day. It was absolutely love at first sight. She asked, you know, she was just incredible. I just come off the beach that day from Barbados to New York. From 86 to sort of 16 degrees. And
what had you been doing all that time?
I'd been on the beach with Ricky Fattah playing guitar. And I'd gone to have Christmas with Lorne Michaels in Barbados, and Paul Simon, who was with Shelley Duvall at the time.
Right.
And he was on 49 ways to leave his lover by that time. He was right at the edge, but he could not get her to go.
It was one lover.
He could not get her to go. Anyway, then Lorne, you know, met me, because we were talking about the Ruttles. I'd shown a clip of the Ruttles on Saturday Night Live, and he said, well, let's make a what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to do a documentary on it for the BBC. He said, well, come and make it for NBC. You'll have a bigger budget. And I said, great. So we met in Barbados, and I was waiting there when he went back to New York and pitched it to NBC. And then I was called for the meeting. You know, yes, they're interested. And so I went in for that.
And Lorne produced, exec produced the Ruttles?
Lorne produced the Ruttles, yes. It was a Broadway video. So it was he had a series of, he had a few late night slots.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, actually, no, this was prime time. He had two, it was put on in prime time initially, where it came 73rd, which is close. But then the late night repeat was huge. And then after that, it went to England and they put it on and they repeated it 4 weeks later, which is something the BBC never did.
It was huge. I remember watching it. When you first showed it on Saturday Night Live, it was just a few minutes short. That's what it was?
It was a clip from like my television series called Rutland Weekend Television.
Okay.
So it was one track, one song, and with me doing the running away from camera joke, you know, talking and the camera keeps moving away. So I have to, you know, so it was that. And then we did A Hard Day's Rut in black and white to the song. And it was fantastic. It was interesting because people wrote in to the Ruttles to SNL. So he had all this fan mail coming in to Dirk and Stig and Nasty. And that was very sweet. And so, you know, it was a really nice time because I had to wait maybe 3 weeks, 4 weeks on the beach while they set it all up. And then I just went into New York to do the, you know, and then I met Tanya, totally in love with her. And I had to live with her in Dan Aykroyd's apartment flat in the Bowery. So I was writing, she'd go off to do her job. And I'd sit there all day with her enormous Alsatian dog writing the Ruttles. It was very lovely. It was in the Bond Street in the Bowery, though. It's really, really scary.
It's not now. Now it's,
no, now it's
the
huge
fashion.
No, for sure.
Well, not now. After COVID, after now it's opening up. It wasn't as fashionable this past year.
It was really fashionable down there. I went down there.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I always stay down there. I love it there.
All it was then was like empty lofts, deserted streets, and CBGBs. Just across the road in Bond Street.
You took me off track time-wise. So the Ruttles was a series that you've been doing.
No, Rutland Weekend Television.
Rutland Weekend Television. And Ruttles, how many had you done of that?
I did two series, which are English series. There was a 6 and a 7, and a Christmas special, which George Harrison was the guest on.
Right.
With that rather wonderful joke.
I'm holding here in my hand, anybody that's looking at this on YouTube, because it's not really television. It's just a thing.
I thought it was radio. I thought it was going to be radio.
No, this is radio. It really is. There's not many people that watch this. We have this for promos mainly.
Okay.
It's mainly so that people can look at it and see some funny thing that you said. And all you have to do basically is say George Harrison or Lorne Michaels, and then I'll say, you know, that's it. Yeah.
Okay.
And then I'll go, I just sit here in awe because I was like 15 and was a Python whore. I mean, I wouldn't have slept with all of you, but I, you know, you wrote things that spoke to me, you know?
It was interesting to me when I came to this country, just how pervasive Python had been. And it was quite interesting because it was only on PBS. It was never on network. It would never still not be on network.
Right.
Nobody would ever put it on television. So, but because PBS was everywhere and you could just get it, it's not measured, but it's there. It's everywhere. And it went around the country. And
there was no money to be seen from that at the time, right? Because that's public
television.
No money,
but we far more valuable is we picked up fans.
Oh, my God.
They would have to buy things, and eventually when, you know, 20 years we didn't make a dime from the Holy Grail because somebody kind of
Somebody
took it. It was opened, you know, by Don Rugoff at Cinema 2, and then somebody got hold of it and kept it going around all the colleges, mm-hmm. making a fortune showing with screenings and that. I don't know how they got the print, but then eventually, after 20 years, the copyright reverted to us and we got it back. And then we could, you know, we began to see some money from it. And then...
Well, that I know for a fact, because I know everything about you. I just forget everything because there's so much about you. And I was able to do your book talk.
You were very kind to do my book.
But you were very kind to ask me. And it's amazing. And it's called, the title of the song from Life of Brian, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. So I'm holding it up. That's what we can run on the promo. And it is so beautiful. There you are from Holy Grail. But it is so apropos, especially now. I mean, COVID is the Black Plague. And people don't want to admit it, but
sure,
it's what it is.
Sure.
And then you're going up and you're on a cross. And how did that, I know how, but I want you to tell everybody, how did that ending, that flourish for Life of Brian come about, that was going to be the song?
Well, we were having problems because we were getting towards the end of, we were writing the film. We were getting towards the end of the film and everybody was headed for crucifixion. I mean, you know, all the characters were being arrested or being sent off. So I said, well, why don't we finish with a song? So what do you mean? So it could be on the cross, you know, we could be singing. And then Gillian went, yeah, we could be kicking our legs and singing. And I said, and it should be like a happy song, like a Disney song, maybe with a little whistle, you know, and it should be like looking on the bright side. And they said, yeah, that sounds good. That's right. We're finished now. And so I went home and I wrote it in about half an hour.
Right.
Because I just had my guitar and I had these jazz chords and I knew it'd have to be Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. And then I just added a whistle, you know. And then you've got the beginning of a song. And it came quite quickly, actually. From
there. It's nice. A perfect song.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's oddly, it's the number one funeral song in England.
I knew that. And I heard it at a funeral here in the States. Because it is the way we're supposed to look at it. When it's not too tragic, if you're able to look outside of it.
Well, I think you have to look outside yourself. I think that's it's helpful. But I think it's really funny because, you know, with a song is so opposite, almost anti-ironic, because they're being crucified. So looking on the bright side of life is right. A very limited,
got a tiny audience,
finite time
right.
That you have left.
Well, a few days, apparently.
Yeah.
According
well, it
to
could
the,
be a few.
Absolutely.
No, absolutely, because you're dying of exposure.
Right.
You know. You're,
right.
You're not. There's nothing. You know, they try and poke them on a bit if it's Good Friday because, you know, the Sabbath's coming. They have to take them down by the Sabbath. That's why he survived.
It's not a Good Friday.
It's pretty good. Good Friday, everybody.
Where did you sit? Because the things you don't talk about that you guys did, that you always have, are, the, you know, first dates. You don't talk about politics, religion. You don't talk about any of it. You don't talk about, people are arguing now, especially in the U.S., and violently arguing, just people. I mean, not even the news that fuels it on. And yet, that's everything you've always tackled, the upstairs, downstairs of the very poor people and the very wealthy. It's, to me, what's so prophetic about everything you've ever been involved with, literally everything.
But it's sort of based on, I think, a British experience. I think there's something about the British experience. It's not American. Comedy isn't really American. It can apply to America, I think, but it didn't really set out to be about America in any way, I don't think. And I think it was sort of satire on the British society. I mean, you know, they think of us as nice, cuddly old folks, but we didn't like them at all.
Right.
We were trying to really irritate them and annoy them. Well, and I think we succeeded.
No, you did things about the royal family. You would do things about royalty, about wealthy people. Did you get a bunch of shit from people for doing it all those years? I mean, you did.
No, because we were put on late on a Sunday night, and like late for the British BBC is 10:30, and on Sunday nights it used to close down at 10, and then there was a picture of the Queen on a horse, and they play the national anthem and say, "Good night, everybody. See you tomorrow."
Sign-off is the Queen on a horse.
There was a picture of the Queen on the horse. You know, Winston,
I never
knew
that.
Singing, "Yeah, absolutely."
Is it still?
Not anymore, because they don't close. I don't know whether they close down anymore. But the BBC thought there was people still awake on a Sunday night.
Right.
And turned out there was.
I am.
And the pubs closed early. They closed at 10, so there was nothing to do and nowhere to be. So they were just feeling out whether there might be an audience here. And there were. So basically, they didn't really interfere with us. They left us alone because we were bringing in a non-existent audience already. So... it wasn't until maybe the third series they began to actually interfere or read the scripts or anything. With the first few shows, Hugh Weldon, who was the head of the BBC entire BBC, came down to the rehearsal rooms and said, "This is so funny."
So he just loved comedy.
He loved it. He said, the gas cooker sketch, he knew all the, you know, he'd watched it, he'd made him laugh, and he actually came to rehearsals to come and say hello to us and a little lowly comedy sketch.
Do you remember how it opened? Was it an introduction to everyone, or did you open with a sketch? And what was that sketch? When the very first, was it Monty Python's Flying Circus, or And Now for Something Completely Different was the movie?
Monty Python's Flying Circus was first, and then And Now for Something Completely Different was made.
This is from an American's point of view, by the way. Sure. That's how I received it.
Yeah, well, it was And Now for Something Completely Different was made deliberately to show Americans, because we figured they wouldn't get the TV show.
Mm-hmm.
And so we took the best sketches after, I think, the second series. We did the best sketches and put them together. And they were paid for by the London Playboy Club, Victor Lowndes, who ran it. And eventually actually sold it, the second half of it, to Mr. Playboy, you know.
Hugh Hefner, yeah.
Yeah. So they ended up owning it, I think. But it wasn't very good. I mean, none of us liked it much. But it was done specifically for that reason.
The best
of,
right. It
cost £80,000. That's what it cost.
My God.
Yeah.
Did anyone see money from that? It was like four walled into theaters, I think. It wasn't distributed naturally.
It didn't come out in America. It came out in England, which was particularly annoying because they then attacked us for just doing old sketches again.
Right.
No, it wasn't for you anyway. But
with the Flying Circus, was... What was the very first, do you remember the very first episode, how that went, how that happened?
I'm not even sure if the first one we taped went out first, to be honest. I think it was out stretching time, with a Canada might have been the first. I really don't know those things, because I was never a fan, you know, we were in it.
Yeah.
You don't go back and watch it again. I probably haven't seen some things for 40, 50 years.
How old were you at that time?
1969, I was 26.
So everybody was in their 20s, except John Cleese who was 72.
Yes, exactly. And has gone on.
Well, you know, his claim to fame is something that all of the stuff that you guys did now, obviously, and there's no money to be seen, is running on TikTok, YouTube, every second of the day. Say no more that's comedy realized. That is.
But that got well known because we did a show when we came in 70, around 1973 or 74. We came to L.A. We toured Canada and we came down to L.A. And there was a show called A Late Night Show. And it was a pop show. The Bee Gees were on. And we did two or three sketches, and one of which was Nudge Nudge. And it was played and played and played and played over the 20 years. I didn't know about it. So everybody knew that sketch, including Elvis. who called everybody Nudge, who called everybody Squire from that sketch. And you go, hey, say no more. Elvis, yes, and he had all the tapes on his plane, every single Python on his plane. There must have been U-matics in those days. And Linda Thompson, his girlfriend, told me that at night when in Nashville, or Memphis, were they in 2 in the morning, Elvis would make her sit up in bed and do Python sketches with him.
Whoa.
Hello, Mrs. Thing! Hello, Mrs. Seriously, that's what he made her do with him.
Did he do the other characters?
Yes. Can you imagine Elvis sitting in bed going, hello, I just buried the cat! Well, no, it wasn't dead, but it's spitting up blood from the trawler well cat! I mean, the mind boggles, isn't it?
That's amazing.
It's just amazing. And then he'd take all his...
That's not in here, is it?
I don't think so.
No, it is not.
And then he'd take all his guys to see Holy Grail. They'd watch it 4 times. You know,
I saw it...
But at once. They'd keep going on again. You know?
Right. I saw it in a theater in Philadelphia. And they had... they kept playing, I've Got a Lovely Bunch of Coconuts. Here they are all standing in a row. A song from the 40s or something. And then they had someone with coconuts in the theater. So they turned it into a Rocky Horror Picture Show type of event in Philly.
Wow.
When it first came out.
Wow.
And I know the story from it, from reading and knowing that you guys had no money, you ran out of money, broke the fourth wall, shot the rich guy, shot the narrator. Did you shoot the narrator? What happened?
The historian gets sliced down by knights. That's quite good. And then it becomes a murder mystery. Well, who killed him? Yeah, it's like... And, you know, the end, it's the worst ending in the world. My daughter said it's the worst ending of any film she's ever seen because the guy just goes, stops it, and the police come in and stop it. She says, that's it. That's your ending.
But
that's
then you
just
look at
shit,
Blazing Saddles. Mel Brooks breaks the fourth wall. It's giant production, but it's the same kind of ending. It's they break the fourth wall, and all the cowboys are in the studios.
Yeah, yeah.
You just did it on the cheap because the movie was made for...
We didn't have enough money to film a battle scene. It was all set up for the battle on the beach, and... They, you know, they did shots of about 20 students holding things in every different angle they could possibly do to make it look like. But we couldn't have them, you know, attacking each other because we didn't have the bodies.
It's a miracle. That movie's a miracle. And Terry Gilliam directed it, right?
No, Terry Jones directed it. Oh, and Terry Gilliam also directed it. So
stupid. So it was the two of them.
The two of them. We said anybody called Terry can direct. This is a shit job and nobody wanted to do it, you know, except those two were kind of very keen. And so... but it was good for that reason because it had both Terry Jones' obsession with trying to get the comedy on screen.
Right.
And then, for example, when he does one scene, he'll hold the camera, not to leave the room till you or anyone else. It's a 4-minute take. That's the live take of us doing it, which is why it's funny. Because you're going to have some editor going, oh, no, you should have a reaction here or you should do this or, you know, all the things that editors do to ruin comedy. It was a choice and it was a good choice because he held a wide frame. And we used to talk about Woody Allen doing that. We used to watch Woody Allen films, Love and Death and things like that. And he does that too. And he's very good at shooting comedy, making sure the comedy's on screen. Gilliam doesn't know a thing about that, but he does know about smoke. And he does know about beautiful boats floating across the lake. And putting those together made it look like a proper film rather than us doing kind of sketches.
Yeah.
And he did the same thing really in... The Meaning of Life, where you open up with a huge, the Crimson Pearl Assurance Society film, which is about 18 minutes before the film actually starts.
Yeah.
So it's there's something for the cineasts, if we can say that.
Yeah. Terry Jones is a huge loss.
Yeah.
Is that one of your tougher ones?
Yeah, well, no, I mean,
they're all tough. I mean,
they would.
They're all tough, but.
Sure, no, but Terry's, he was so sweet, but he did it. Slowly. I mean, I had to direct him at the O2 when we did the concert there. And I was very worried because he was having trouble remembering words. So I put up a lot of auto cues and things and cards. And it was written all over the place. I said, don't worry, Terry. We're going to get you through this. This is our problem, not your problem. And we'll do it. And we did it. And you can occasionally see he's struggling a little. But...
Was it dementia?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, but, you know, he was very sweet. He actually came to a Python meeting about 5 years ago, and he came in, and, you know, he's very sweet. He didn't say anything, and then you know, somebody said, offered us some water. And he said, no, 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 no. And Michael said, it's okay. He means yes. It's like, that's such a Python sketch.
Right? It totally
when
is.
He says no, he means yes, okay.
Oh my God. It's so much. It's so much comedy. And the whole world. And you, people don't even know this, the first 5 years of Saturday Night Live, you hosted it four times in the first 5 years.
We turned up for the first season because we were on stage at City Center. We did like 4 or 5 weeks at City Center. It was a huge show, Python show.
Right.
And Lorne came and introduced everybody, and we met them. They all came to the opening party. And so one night on a Saturday night, it must have been, Gilliam and I went along to 8H, and we went and saw them in the middle of the show. They're doing the show. It's 11:30, something like that. And it was odd because they had the Muppets.
Yeah, they were those big Stonehenge-type creatures.
Yeah. And then I think Belushi and Aykroyd were very unhappy about the Muppet business. But then Lorne and Claire, you know, they spun them off, and they went to London, and were huge, became the Muppet Show.
Right. And Jim Henson was represented by Bernie Brillstein, who was a friend of mine, who represented Belushi and was also obviously Lorne's. A dear close friend of his.
Lorne's manager, yeah. Lorne's manager, really, yeah.
And Lorne's. And yeah. Lorne did something funny to me once, because he liked a practical joke, some people, when he could. And I was close with Brad Gray, so we were in St. Thomas, and we were out at some beach, and I didn't know it was the Paparazzi Beach. And I said, I'm going to go swimming. And Lorne said, oh, this is the perfect place to go. Go right out there. Just take your shirt off. Just go on out there. And I just carelessly just ran out there. And then the next day, my man boobs were all over anywhere. It was National Enquirer time. So it was pre-internet. It was a lovely experience. And my friend Brad was like, well, what do you expect? I mean, that's where everybody's.
It was St. Bart's. Yeah.
Wherever that is, you know where it is. I mean, it's the place where everybody goes.
I stayed there.
To get their picture taken, if they want it to be taken, to show their new
body.
Well,
yes and no. Yeah, sure.
This is the body I didn't want to show.
No. It's funny.
But you've been friends with Lorne all these years, right?
Yeah. I that's when we met him. We met him in that's the City Center time. But he actually had come to England and watched us make a show, which I did not know. I don't think we met him at that time. He came and watched us rehearse, saw how we rehearsed, and then he saw that he came into the studio and watched us do the studio day. And then finally we have an audience, and then we do it like as a live show, you know, and he watched that. And then he came back and he pitched SNL to NBC as a mix between 60 Minutes and Monty Python.
Oh, my God.
That was his pitch.
God, he's smart.
Yeah, very smart. Well, it seemed to work, okay.
So your first appearance was the second season.
Do you remember it vividly? Yeah, I do, because I came in for the previous week, as you do, and it's terrifying. You sit there and you go, oh, shit, that'll be me next week. And then Chevy did a fall and really hurt himself, so he was out. And so there's not much to do in the week before you're on.
Right.
So I would hang out. I went to sit with Chevy and, you know, talk, and it was nice. I got to know him, but he was in bed, so he's like, he really injured himself.
It changed television in the United States.
Absolutely
forever,
changed.
And Canada forever.
Because someone like Gilliam, Terry Gilliam, who's American born, mm-hmm. had to come to England to get a job. He couldn't, you know, he'd done Harvey Kurtzman's Mad magazine, but he couldn't get work, or, you know, so he came over and hung around us.
How did you guys meet? Were you doing like a Groundlings type workshop? Is that what you were doing? Did you do small shows?
For Terry Gilliam?
Yeah.
We're doing Michael, Terry Jones and I had a children's television show called Do Not Adjust Your Set.
I have it right here. I have all the answers, and yet I come out of here with nothing.
The Bonzo Dog Doodah Band were in that with Neil Innes. And then, you know, then Gilliam came along. And he had some sketches, and he had some written sketches, and he'd drawn some things. And I loved his drawings. His drawings were fantastic. And then I said, well, he wanted to be involved with us. And then Mike and Terry went, oh, America? No. And I said, look, he's got something. No, I don't know what it is, and I don't know what made me say that, but I got him in. he joined us, which is like really kind of a bit strange. It was the worst thing I ever did.
Changed his life.
Yeah.
And he's a very, everybody knows he's a very even-tempered, normal guy.
He's fairly even-tempered. I mean,
God, I would have done anything to work with him because he's, the lunacy is so fantastic. And he finally got his Don Quixote thing done.
Yep, he did. I always liked him very much. He was very funny. He is very funny.
He's quite brilliant.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
All of
it. Oh, yeah, but I love his, I have some of it, but I love his drawings and his cartoons.
Well, the animation was, it saved all the big budget stuff.
But I think what the animation did
was... The amount of cliffs you all fell off of.
Yes, absolutely. But I think what it did was it provided a sort of Victorian framework for the film.
Right.
The show.
Yeah, yeah.
Where everything seemed to be part of this odd Victorian box. So in the sketches and then there were a bit of animation in the sketches. But it seemed to make it all about something. And we did try and make themes go through it. I mean, if we had we'd write a lot of sketches and then we'd chuck them into different shows because that would seem to be a theme emerging, or that would be a theme emerging, and we could link it and come in and out. And that was kind of fun. That was like Python committee writing, whereas the actual sketches were often done in little groups of individuals.
Right, which is not unlike how Saturday Night Live has modeled itself. That's exactly the same way. Someone will write a sketch with someone else for themselves. And then the ones that are group written, were those in many ways the most fun times or also the most difficult because you had many personalities?
I don't think we actually, I mean, what we do group-wise is tend to be shaping and putting things in and saying, well, that's a bit similar to that. So now put that sketch there, put it 2 weeks apart. You know, so with that was kind of fun. I like doing that because you can pick up themes and work through them. And that gives it some sort of extra thing, which is I think to do with story. We like story. We like to be told things through story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's and Python didn't seem overtly have anything in common, but it actually had some things in common, certainly attitude.
And to this day, everybody's different personalities, completely different personalities. Mm-hmm. But there's a certain no matter what you do, you are kin to these gentlemen. This, even if there were conflicts or throughout or whatever, there's no way that you're part of.
Yeah,
it's Beatles in its own way. And is that what you set out to be?
A football team. It's like a Liverpool football team. You know, mm-hmm. We'll play together at that one time. If he was running down the wing, I knew to push the ball in front of him because I knew he'd be there. You know, you learn how to. I think we were very good at covering for each other. It was actually, it didn't have any dominating ego insofar as that John could have done a show of his own, but he came and picked up all these other people to do a show with him, his own show, supposedly his own show, but wasn't.
Right.
And I think that was kind of smart because he didn't want to be a star of his own show. He didn't want to go the way Marty Feldman had just gone.
Right. Did he not enjoy Fawlty Towers being...
But that was afterwards. He did Fawlty Towers when he'd fed up with us. You know, he
was fed up? Is that how you looked at it?
I mean, he left. He left Python at the end of the tour of Canada after the third series. He announced he would, you know, and then he did. And we came down to California and had a lovely time. You know, it was really nice.
So he was... Do you think you would have stayed together?
Did stay together because what happened was the fourth series that BBC wanted with just the five of us, and they punished us by not having John by calling it, they took Monty Python from it. They called it the Flying Circus.
Right.
Or was it the other way around? I can't remember. They removed one or the other as a punishment. But the fact is that we then went on to write films.
We got together. I have pages on this, but I can't look. It's too painful. Fuck these pages. You know what? We're going to take a quick break because I have sponsors. Usually it's stuff that shaves people's parts or steaks you can buy. You can shave your steaks.
Really?
Yeah. Or it's good stuff. Some of it's mental health stuff. I do that. I like having those sponsors.
But
we'll be right back. If you had a show to do, say you were doing... When you guys did the Hollywood Bowl, for example, were backstage, were people inebriated in the group, or was everybody doing caffeine? I mean, there was no Red Bull back then. Were there other things going on? We know there were sex, drugs, and rock and roll because that's what life was back then.
Not really in Python. I mean,
I don't picture John Cleese having sex.
I think he's done it. He has a couple of daughters.
But he does. It's very hard to do if you're doing silly walks. It's very hard to get your penis out. He would sneer at me so heavily if he heard that.
He would be very upset, I think. He didn't like silly walks because he didn't write it.
Oh, that's interesting.
If he didn't write it, it's not funny.
And it's all over the internet. It is.
Silly walks.
Oh, my God.
There's a silly walks day in Europe.
Yes.
In some January or February. It's like a silly walks day. It's written by Mike and Terry.
Oh, my God.
But John performed it consummately because his body was fantastic. I mean, he was a really good right wing footballer, soccer player.
Didn't know that.
And, if you see the philosopher's football, he's on the right wing and he puts the cross across to me and I'm Sophocles and I head it into the net. One of the finest little goals. It is offside, though. They were right.
So Spamalot, question, I'm jumping. Spamalot is an annuity. Spamalot was...
Well, it is, except have you seen any productions on recently?
No, but we haven't been able to.
Exactly. So they still pay, right?
They can't pay when there's no productions.
Ah, okay.
So people have to be in the seats.
So I wouldn't be. It isn't quite an annuity then.
So let me do the math. But it was an incredible windfall.
It absolutely was, and certainly something I never saw coming. And it was a really nice time in my life to get that because my daughter was about 12 or 13, and she loved the show, and we were able to go to New York a lot and see the show, and it was fun, and it was lovely.
Was it 4 years?
One of the best years of my life.
Did it run 4 years on Broadway?
It ran for about 4.5 years on Broadway. Well, it's been running ever since. I mean, I think something like 30 million people have seen it worldwide.
Now, everybody wants to know, because I want to know, and we talked briefly about it before we started doing this, which is a movie of Spamalot. What's involved? Does Handmade Films exist anymore? Or it's gone with George?
No. He was a robber baron. We had to sue him. When George finally got rid of him, he owed Handmade Films $30 million, George.
So it was basically just working for the arts. He was doing what he loved.
Well, at first, I mean, The Life of Brian was the first film, and then they made money on that, which was a mistake because they were Bialystok and Bloom. They didn't want to make money, so they had to collapse it and sell it to the Dutch Antilles or something because he was supposed to lose money as a tax dodge. Not a tax dodge. I mean, it's a write-off.
Right. But oh my God!
Exactly.
Did you come to?
It was literally George
Harrison we're talking about, by the way, people know. Yeah, right.
Yeah. George Harrison paid for the entire budget of The Life of Brian, which was $4.5 million in those days, which is quite a lot.
15 to 18
at least, I would think.
You wouldn't be able to make that movie for that. You can't shoot over there at the moment.
Nobody else would have made that.
You can shoot over there, but you can't film over there.
But we made it in Tunisia, but we were bought by EMI, who then read it and went freaked out and crazy. And so,
yeah, how the hell did that get made? I mean, we're talking about what people would consider to be sacrilege, and I showed it to my wife, who's half Sicilian, raised very Christian, and just loved the movie because it was able to accomplish something, dealing with a faux Jesus character.
Yes, because it's not mocking Jesus. It is actually a nightmare to be mistaken for the Messiah.
That's the brilliance.
Is a terrible nightmare.
Yeah.
And no, you will tell us. You know, and it's I think that's what we found after we took about 3 years to write it bit by bit. You know, but I think that's one of the things we found that I think was quite interesting, is that made it literally about a guy trapped in a nightmare.
Yeah.
And that you sympathize with his nightmare, and he ends up being crucified, and there's this bastard next to him singing to cheer up, you know.
So Graham Chapman had a humility about him.
Graham was the best lead. I mean, he really was. He was a genuinely good actor. And Holy Grail, he had an alcohol problem, so he couldn't remember more than one line. So if you look at the cutting of the film, it goes, "I am Arthur," line. King of the Britons, Lion, whose castle is this? Lion.
That's so why it's so great. It's great. He makes these announcements, and then they cut to other. It was people. Out of necessity. I had no. I mean, I memorized the movie. I know the movie by heart.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that was Graham, and you know,
for Knights of St. E, are they on ladders? Is that what they're on? With a robe over it?
I have no idea.
That's all I needed to know.
I mean, in when a stage show, they're on the Hanker's area. Would have to wear, those feet stilts.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had a stick, I think, to steady him with an owl head on.
So I would go to Equinox, and I was doing this play called Privilege by Paul White, and Hank was in Spamalot, and it's so funny. Kevin McCullum is calling me, and that is the producer of Drowsy Chaperone that Casey Nicolau directed.
Wow.
Kevin is one of the producers.
I know. I saw Drowsy Chaperone here in LA.
I took over for Bob Martin.
That's right. I'd forgotten that.
And Bob Martin.
Of course, that's really, your connection
didn't
with Casey.
Love Drowsy Chaperone?
I like the Drowsy Chaperone very much, yes. Yeah. And I thought he was very good. My wife has never forgiven Bob Martin.
Why? What did he do?
Because he didn't put an intermission in.
No.
He went off and had a pee, and the entire audience is going, how dare you go and pee when we're desperate?
And I played that part. It was only 70 minutes to play. And there's a pee break built in for the person who plays Man in Chair, that character, right before that intermission.
He does.
Oh, no, it's right after it.
He's right after it.
I can't remember my cue.
It's when because you're bursting for a pee.
You are, and there's a horrifically racist bit that follows it. Oh. It was wonderful. But not now. I don't think they would allow it at the moment. But it was supposed to be a takeoff on Flower Drum Song. That was the idea. And Danny Burstyn, my friend, was in it. But anyway, Mike Nichols directed Spamalot, and Hank Azaria and was in it. And I would jog next to him on the treadmills, and he was in quite great shape because he was dancing in armor. And you had David Hyde Pierce in that. And I mean, it was amazing, the people you
Wonderful
had.
Cast.
And you had Mike Nichols directing it.
Absolutely. And the best director I've ever worked with and the best, most helpful person I've ever written for. I mean, he was just amazing, immaculate, because he was a comedian. He started off as a comedian.
Of course.
With Nichols and May. And oddly, when I was at Cambridge, at college, I loved Nichols and May. Mm-hmm. And I had the records and played them. And then when I came to America in about 1975, I went to a party, and this guy started. We started to talk, and we were funny, and we talked, and we went on for about 2 hours, and we did, and this, and we talked about art, literature, then funny, then, you know. And I said, "Who was that?" And he said, "Oh, that's Mike Nichols." And they went, "Oh, God!" So we've been friends since we were friends for a long time before we worked together.
And so, did you approach him to direct it?
Yeah, I mean, Bill Haber came here, and I had all the dolls out and the records things, you know, because they're little life-size dolls. I showed him what it would look like and the script, and I played him some of the songs we demoed. And he said, I'm in, you know. And I said, well, a workshop? He said, no, this stuff's worked for 30 years. We don't need a workshop.
Right.
So, okay. So, and then on the way out, he said, well, who should we get to direct? And I said, well, obviously I'd love Mike. He said, well, yeah, everybody would love Mike, but, you know, he doesn't, you know, it takes him about a year to get back to you, you know, so he's so in demand. So I said, well, just send it to him anyway, because he likes our songs. He'd love John Dupre's songs that we'd written. He'd love them. And from The Meaning of Life, we'd given him all the songs. And he came back, and I picked up the phone 3 days later, and he said, yes, yes, yes.
And then when did you hit the ground from there?
Another year, because, you know, it's. I think he had to become available, the deals had to be done, you know, one of those. But still.
I went up to him, I saw the play. You weren't in New York, and I didn't know you, so I don't think you would have said come backstage. But I had met Mike Nichols, and I knew him through Diane Sawyer, his wife, and I saw them in Esca, the play, the wonderful restaurant that was, I'm sure you ate at, the seafood, whatever. I'm sure Mike took you there. It was one of his favorites. I walked up and I was complimenting him on the play. And he said, what's your favorite thing in it? I said, you know what killed me? And I saw it a few times. What killed me tonight is when the people are doing the reenactment of From Fiddler on the Roof, the bottle dance. And they're going, hey, 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 hey. And very slowly from the left of the proscenium of the a bale of hay is being dragged in a wagon very slowly, very Python style, across the entire stage. And it was just the one time as it's about to leave proscenium, they just point and go, they point
everybody
at
went, hey!
And I, yeah, it was good. So.
Casey Nicholas joke, not mine.
It is. Casey directed Book of Mormon. I mean, my God. But before that, he was the choreographer. He was the director for me on Drowsy Chaperone. And
that
then
was
he
his
came
first.
To you to be the choreographer.
It was his first job choreographing. And the really odd thing was, I only got into the musical business by Garth Drabinsky, who asked me to write the book for Seussical.
Oh, my God.
And he gave me this task, and I thought, oh, this is fun. And I had to read. I didn't know Seuss very well because I grew up in England, obviously. And so I read every book of Seuss and every biography and everything I could, and I had to choose what the play would be. So I chose, you know, Horton. So he, because it's a nice, you've got large and a small. And I wrote this, the treatment for it, and then sent it to Lynn, and they wrote some beautiful melodies. And they kept trying to get me in to play Cat in the Hat.
Which that would have been so great.
Yeah, but except my daughter might have missed me eventually at school.
Yeah,
don't you think?
It is a long. That's what's nice about me is I haven't, what's horrible about me is I haven't done a full run. What's great about me is I'll do 4 months. You know, I'll do 75 to 100 shows, and then, but you're not the original, person in the part, but you're not spending a year of your life gone.
I couldn't do that.
So I'm all over the place because I just want to be. But when Spamalot happened, I remember what that was. I saw a lot of the accolades. It was a big thing.
It was huge. It was unexpected, and it was very pleasant because we opened in Chicago and it went sold out before you. The run was sold out because we had a brilliant cast, and also Python, you know, it's pretty well known, Holy Grail. So, but it, there was no guarantee it was going to work, and we you know, we cut two or three songs, and it was pretty much as it hit the deck running. It was pretty good, you know. And then when it came to New York, people hadn't expected it, and it sort of snuck in, and then it won the Tony, which was just unbelievable. I never. Imagine such a thing. And then they immediately sold it, I think, to Steve Wynn.
Right.
And we were sort of, we were whole within 5 months or something. It was an unheard of recoupment of $11 million.
Back in Vegas. And
yeah.
Yeah. I heard he didn't see it. Oh, I heard he couldn't see it. I'm sorry. Now, is that bad? Is that in bad taste? He's not funding my stuff. I've never hung out with him.
Really?
Is he a nice man?
Can we cut?
We're not going to break it. I guess we should.
Yes,
probably.
He can be a nice man. He loved Spamalot.
Well, and, that makes him a great man.
Yes, and I remember the night he came to see it because the producer
came to be there.
He came to be watching the show.
Right.
And the producer said to me, Steve Wynn's in. And I said, who? And he said, they're from Vegas. It's a very big deal.
Yeah.
Will you sit next to him? I said, well, what about you? He said, I've got to go. I've got this thing. Mike's got this thing. You sit next to Steve Wynn. So I sat next to Steve.
Well, he must love that. I mean, if he's a Python fan.
And after about a few minutes, he said, Vegas is going to love this, he said, putting his hand on my knee. And I said, well, it might, but I'm not very fond of it. But,
but Vegas is going to love what I'm doing to you. Yeah.
But then he gave us a ride home on this enormous 747, you know, with dogs. Tanya loved it because he had his dogs in it.
Mm-hmm.
And he rode us home, and he was really all over it. And then I went to Vegas and I saw every show there because I thought, well, we have to adapt it for Vegas in a way. And
you didn't put people on trapezes. You didn't Cirque du Soleil it.
No, but I thought we could have gone a bit more extreme because we had to cut it down. You had to cut it to Vegas. They don't want you to come back. They don't want an intermission.
Yeah.
So you do 70 minutes. Bang straight through.
Right.
So you have to take out 20 minutes or something and the intermission, and then it's straight through.
Any talk of more burlesque in it? Were you going to go that route with
it? I suggested to him that at nighttime the girls should be topless.
Yeah, I knew you would because that's
show business.
That's show business, and it's also your
it's Vegas.
Your roots. When you look at the many things, you did a wonderful, was it a book of sexual positions?
Yes.
And
the Vatican Sex Manual.
Right.
So now, it's 70 ways, positions in which you can't have sex.
Right.
So you're unable to have
and
sex.
You can't because you're not can't. Facing
well,
each
your
other.
Your head's in the wrong place and your knees are, you know, yes, it's illustrated, by the way. So
you were in
luckily.
Fabulous shape, by the way. And you were, your spine was malleable. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. And I've looked at it many, many times. Couldn't take my eyes on you. But looking at that, did you get a lot of, I'm just going all over because I can't help it. I want to free associate when I talk to you. I don't know why. It shouldn't be free. I'm not but funny. I'll be funny next week. It's not free. It's costing me a lot.
That is?
I don't know. Yes.
At least I don't have gas money because I've got the Tesla. You know.
That is so great that you have that, by the way. That is.
I plugged it into your computer. Is that okay? It also downloads most of the things you've got on there. But
yeah, it's nothing. It's nothing but pictures from your sex manual. did you get in trouble from that?
From what?
From having nude photos of yourself with the Vatican mentioned.
How could they give you?
Get any religious groups outraged or anything?
I think it's the sort of joke that I mean. I've in my experience, and I've known several people who are, you know, religious, and I've known Jesuits, and they always love it—a good joke.
You see, that's where we're not at right now. That's where we're not
because
at.
You have evangelicals who are, you know, not
puritanical, and there's a lot of rules, yeah, and but, humor's gone. You
everything's gone because you're now it's just a cult. You're under control.
Yeah,
and that's not humanity, and that's not, you know, it's not religion, really. I don't think. I mean, I had my best friend George Harrison from about 1975, and he taught me more about anything. But the only thing we actually disagreed on was religion, which we agreed never to sort of argue about it because he was, you know, a committed Hindu, and I was with him on his deathbed, and he was very happy because he wasn't going to be reincarnated. I mean, you know, come back in human form.
Right.
He was a Shri, you know, he was kind of high. And I said, because I think I could do with a bit more. You know, I'd come back, you know.
You would care to come back?
Yeah, I don't find humanity that horrible. I mean, I like human beings. I think we've done rather well. I think it's an extraordinary species.
You think we're just going through some speed bumps right now?
Well, I think, you know, when the rats fill up the cage, so the pressures are on to get off the planet, and that's why you see Musk and all those people getting ready
they wanna,
to go off.
Yeah, we can't fix this one, so let's go put rubbish out in there.
That will inevitably be the impetus to get off, is why would you leave this amazing planet?
Yeah, this beautiful,
beautiful, beautiful planet.
That we can fix.
And we will.
It's not too late.
I think we will, because I think that the options are not great. And I think people don't really, I think they think they have an option. That's what's so weird about this thing, that this actually is going to happen. It's not like, well, it may happen. No, it's happening. So if you're not, you know, if you, I don't know, I don't understand why people deny it.
Denying that we're destroying the planet and deforestation and
because there's going to be huge, horrible, you know, and it's interesting we start off with a pandemic because I think there will be more of these sort of things. And also, you know, someone like Bangladesh may just disappear.
Right.
I mean, it's a delta.
But yet you're hopeful that this is what humanity does. It fails forward.
I think this is a great species. I think it's Homo sapiens sapiens. So it's two wisdoms. And I think
stuttering. I'm sorry. I thought.
I think we have a lot of very, very brilliant people on the planet who have done remarkable things, and that, you know, we still sort of think we're all different nations and stupidities like that. But I think sport brings everybody together, and we're doing better at getting to understand that the pandemic has proved to everybody it's only one world. It's only the Earth. You can't get off it.
But they don't want it to be that way. They want to go back to their little cubbies.
But you cannot go back once. The pandemic won't leave you alone. It's
no.
not going to.
And you're right. It's not going to be just this pandemic. There's going to be other things that happen. And
well, we know that because it's happened. And we adapt. And we've survived. We survived the plague.
But most humans can't track 100 years. They don't care about 100 years. You can look at history. I can look at what I know and go, okay, so 500 years ago, this happened. 800 years ago, this happened, whatever we can track. So this is one of those things, and it's right. monumental, but people don't care to do that because this isn't what we had 15 years ago, you know? That's how short-sighted. They don't want to look at the long,
well,
grand
I think
scheme.
One of the problems of people is that they, my generation come out of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So we know how bad things really can get. I mean, we come out of the devastation of Europe. I'm born in 1943. There's two more years of a war when they're sending, you know, V2s all over bombing. And but so that life was something that you were grateful for. They stopped trying to kill us. You know, that was kind of a deal.
Yeah.
And so it was rationing and it was horrible and it was blitzy. But then suddenly, my generation came up with rock and roll and they suddenly became the Beatles and they became the Who and they became all of that. And art was, they became artists and photographers and designers.
Isn't that interesting how there's a huge surge of that after disaster?
Absolutely, because
that's how we recover.
What happens, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
You always have a renaissance after a disaster. That's what you do. And then, I think, you know, we're going to have like the 20s again, probably, aren't we, after COVID?
I think so.
Yeah.
This is,
people will go crazy. And
I think there's going to be a lot of people wanting entertainment in a big way. I think movies are going to come back in theaters. I think people want to collect.
They have. I think that's proved this weekend. I think that's true. Mm-hmm. I think people like that experience of shared. And we are very societal as an animal. We like society. So we'd like to be in a theater experiencing things with other people. We'd like to be in a cinema experiencing things with other
people. And kids with schools, that's been a disaster. That has been a very psychologically, for their lives, this will be a hit that is PTSD for kids. Not the last that they're going
to
have.
It'll be very interesting. I don't know. It'll be very interesting to see who prospered and who didn't.
Right. I might have liked it. I didn't have many friends as a kid.
Exactly. I think the SWATs will have liked it. And people who were bullied will have liked it.
I was bullied a bit. So, I lived in Norfolk, Virginia, and kids would say racist things to me.
Really?
Yeah. They would.
America's famous for that. Right?
Well, I don't know why. I mean, they just came here and slaughtered their natives.
Well,
but didn't you guys do that originally in England? Not you.
We slaughtered natives?
I think so. What was there before the proper British people came over? Where did they come?
No proper British people. You got a series of tribes. You got the Picts, the Saxons, the Anglos, the Jutes, and they all sort of fight each other.
Did they all come from Vikings? So they came basically.
No, the Vikings came and raped everybody from the north, and then you get the Normans coming from the France, and then you get the Angles and the Saxons and the Celts were all from that side. So this is huge.
But who were the native people of?
There's no native people anywhere. Only people who were there at this time.
Got it.
Even the native people who were here weren't here before that because they came down on the land bridge, possibly on the boats. Not many of them. They came from, over from China, up that way.
You've always had a huge knowledge of history. So in school, did you study everything that had to do with where we came from?
I was in a boarding school from the age of 7 to 19, 12 years in Wolverhampton, which is not a pretty place. It's miserable. And so there's an awful lot of time at boarding school. You have all the evenings too. You have not homework, but you have prep. And then you've got all the weekends, and there's like 14-week terms. So I found my escape through reading. And I like reading. I studied English literature, history, and geography. And I think those are, they tell you where you are, what you might be thinking, and what can go wrong. No, I think they're a very good basis for an education, for a survivalist, which is sort of what I am, really, trying to still stay alive after World War II.
Right.
You know.
Do you have any memories? Were you were already like 2 years old when the war ended?
I remember two things. I remember the sound of the siren. Terrifying, where you fled down into the Anderson shelters. And I remember a Mickey Mouse gas mask, which I had. They give kids a Mickey Mouse gas mask.
Oh my God.
And you put it on, and it's like rubber. And it's Mickey. So I've hated Disney and scuba diving ever since.
Some people wear them for sex now.
Really?
Yeah, I do.
The Mickey Mouse?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because I'm a big fan. Nothing
weird about you. You don't wear the mini one.
No. I wear it, but somewhere else.
Oh.
Yeah, I
thank
wear
you.
It. It's like wearing two masks. So, my God, so you're coming out of the war ending, so it's rejoiceful. So your childhood is rebuilding.
Well, we don't know what the war is. We don't know anything other than the war. We're born in, 43. I'm born in 43. Mike's born in 43. I think Gilliam's 1940. Cleese is a phony war baby. He's born in 1939, before the war.
So he saw real stuff. Did he?
Probably not. I don't know. He was, because he was in Clifton, which is maybe he might.
There was a movie John Borman made, Hope and Glory, which shows his childhood, which is in proper London.
Right.
And bombs coming down and destroying the homes.
And then the kids were, you know, moved away into the country.
But Cleese
and all that,
didn't see that, you're saying.
Well, I'm from the north of England, and Cleese, I don't know. I mean, I don't know his.
There has to be something that turned him into him. There had to be some definable moment.
Well, I think the fact that he was probably 6'1" when he was 12. And
that's
people
true, right?
Laughed.
Right.
And then he decided, well, I'll decide when they laugh. So he would give, he was a proper public school. He was at Clifton College. And he would, he was famous for doing impersonations of Hitler. And he would go and do that at his school.
Right.
But he was very happy at school, John. And the interesting thing about his biography, autobiography, is that he goes back to his public school to teach Latin for 2 years when he should have gone to Cambridge. But I think what happened was everybody came back from the war and they gave them all places at the universities. The returning RAF and servicemen, they went into the... And so he had to wait. And so he went back to teach Latin at his boarding school. So it's like, you know, that
my
one.
God.
Romani's A. Yeah, you know, that's all him, really.
I want to ask you about five more things that take about 2 to 3 hours apiece. So we're going to take one more break, and we'll be right back with the one and only Eric Idle. I have to ask about George Harrison, because he's, for a lot of people, one of the more beautiful people that has lived. Yes, we know him, of course, for his work, but also as a human and as a soul. Well, how did you meet? I think it was 75, you were saying. I'm not sure if that's the right year.
It was 1975, and we, Gilliam and I were asked to fly to L.A., to attend a screening at the Directors Guild, the old Directors Guild on Sunset.
Mm-hmm.
And so we came in, and then Gilliam and I were taken around in a horrible sweaty car. It was hot, boiling. And we would do interviews, and we had a screening. And then there was the screening at the Directors Guild. And at the end of it, George suddenly appeared behind us. We were standing at the back. He said, "Oh, well, there you are. I've been waiting for you. I've been trying to meet you for ages." And he said, "Let's go and have a reefer in the projection booth." And I said, "Oh, okay." So, you know what? We went to the projection booth. The projectionist just watches some of the cast come in, and that beetle lighting up a joint. So, okay. And we were thrown out of there eventually, because I think they had another screening of something. So then we went off to dinner. There's a picture of us having dinner. And then George and I went on, and he took me to A&M, where he was, Tom Scott was working on his album, George's Extra Texture. And then he said, "Do you want to meet Joni?" And I said, "What?" He said, "Well, she's next door." I said, "Are you kidding?" So we went door and met Joni Mitchell. And then we played me some tracks. And then we went back to the Beverly Wilshire, and we talked all night. It was just like, that was love at first sight. We just talked, and we had so much in common, because we'd both been in these groups, powerful groups, with powerful, brilliant people.
Yeah,
and yet we were sort of we were sort of solo people, on our own. So I think there was a connection, because we filled a similar position in the group. You know, mm-hmm. this person who doesn't have a partner, it doesn't, you know, and you know, I think we both learned to how to get our own material into the bigger group's work with only one vote. So George had to wait for a long time, you know, to get his. You know, he could have one track on an album, perhaps, and yet he wrote possibly the most brilliant Beatles songs of all time. I mean, Here Comes the Sun is it, isn't it?
Well, My Guitar Gently Weeps is an anthem. I mean, it's, and I was just listening to All Things Must Pass.
Yeah, I love that.
Well, that's an anthem for right now. I mean, relevance. But what keeps you relevant is that you're right on the cusp of what humankind goes through.
But George was very, very, I mean, the first thing he told me is it's all about death. He said, "It doesn't matter how much money you make, or if you're the most famous people in the world, you're going to die."
Yeah.
I realized that. I thought, "Well, can't take any of this with me. You know, what am I going to do with my life?" And so And what he did with his life was prepare for his death in a very interesting way, but do good, to really help people and to be a spokesman. And, you know, he single-handedly brought Indian culture into the West.
Yes, he did.
And this is a rock guitarist from Liverpool. I mean, you can do anything if you set your mind to it.
And he brought the other Beatles to the Maharishi? Is that how that happened?
He did. And that's true. And off they went to India. And I like the Ruttle version. You know, they met Arthur Sultan. And but George would always refer to them as the Ruttles. When he was talking to me about the Beatles, he said, the Ruttles, when we were in the Ruttles. All the time. And I actually gave him a Ruttle guitar, and there's a picture of him, and he looked so happy getting this Ruttle guitar.
So he had your whimsical sense of humor.
Oh, George is a tremendous. I mean, you know, his best. You know, he had Peter Sellers at his house. He was, you know, he was very, very fond of comedy. They were all very. The reason they were successful in America, I believe, is the Beatles were funny.
Yeah.
And when they hit the airport, they were so funny.
Yeah.
What's that haircut? You know, called, you know, bread. How'd you find America? Turn left and green. You know, it was all those one-liners, and they were absolutely enchanting. And it was Ringo that made them popular, because here's this big-nosed guy.
Right.
And he's the drummer, he's in a rock group. And everybody, oh, he's just like a regular person.
And he's doing throwaways. And yet John would say something incredibly poignant in the middle and kind of bring it to a halt and then do a Groucho kind of way out.
Yeah. But, I mean, they were so extraordinary. I mean, they're all individually still. I mean, the ones alive are still, you know, extraordinary. Extraordinarily talented. It was a very interesting story, and I was glad I had the task of doing that, because when I did the Ruttles, I had to read everything about the Beatles, obviously, mm-hmm. and then got magazines and everything, interviews, and then George showed me a film called The Long and Winding Road, which was their compilation, which none of them could agree which bits to cut or to lose, so there was still a bit of that. It came out eventually in the 90s when they did that anthology thing, you know.
Right.
A lot of that material.
Which was good. The anthology was quite beautiful.
Yeah, no,
I mean, how could it not be? But it was different versions.
I look forward to the new one.
Well, Peter Jackson is making it. Yeah, it's the new cut of Let It Be, pretty much, right? Mm-hmm. And he's got 30 hours of footage or something like that.
Yeah, and I mean, documentary.
Have you seen anything? Have you?
No, I haven't seen anything at all. But I'm anxious to see it, because it was such a sad film in the end. And documentary always focuses on what goes wrong.
Yeah.
Do you notice that? When people said to Mike and I, they said, we want to make a documentary of the making of it, went, no chance. Because a rehearsal is when you are supposed to fuck up.
Yeah.
That's the point of it. You learn how not to be funny.
And have difficulties.
And then let's move on. So, but a documentary focuses on people in tears, or it wants all of that.
And that's what's so beautiful about what I've heard Peter Jackson say, was that they had so much fun doing Let It Be.
Exactly.
And the idea was to be on top of the building and record it.
Yeah.
And that looked miserable. It looked like people are medicated to forget about it. And it was supposed to be the second, Abbey Road was supposed to be the last album, from what I understand.
Right.
And they just switched it because they didn't feel Let It Be was, I don't know. It's got amazing music on it.
It's got lovely music on it. And also they play a long time, but each one of them, I think, leaves and has a bit of a nervous. They're getting to the sort of age when men need to be married and go off and get boring, you know, have children. And that's the age. You can't be young men running around, you know, shagging everybody for, you know, you can't do that.
Yeah,
that's
but you're married,
people.
Happily married. I'm happily married. And yes, you're not boring at all.
I didn't say I was bored.
No, but boring. You said you had to get married to get boring.
No, but I think there's something about youth that communicates in rock and art and comedy, particularly in comedy. Yeah.
Right.
And also saying things that aren't said, and that, you know, that these people are moving on, and you're moving up the ladder, you know?
Yeah. So how many people were around when George was passing? You said you were there.
Well, it was a couple of weeks, and we came back from France, and he'd called me in France, and he said, I said, how are you doing? He said, I'm doing all right. I'm writing the liner notes for my album. I said, oh, how's it going? He said, well, it's going all right. And he said, and if I don't do them, then you will. And I suddenly realized he was going to die. Or that was in the frame. This was in France. And then we came back, and then he was in this house. He was actually in Paul's house. Paul had lent him this house on Coldwater. Mm. And, he was occasionally, he'd be racked by pain because he was a tremendous smoker. I'm afraid the harshest thing I think I've ever done is at his funeral, I said, I'd like to thank Marlborough, without whom we wouldn't be here today. Comedians, eh?
Yeah.
But what
that,
is it?
That's, I haven't been to a funeral where that hasn't happened. I did it with my parents. I haven't been able to do it with like a sister. I wasn't able to do a joke.
You do need a laugh.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
you were at Robin's funeral, right?
I was at Robin's, memorial anyway. Yes. I sang a little song with Lily. I wrote a little song for him. Because I still can't address his absence, actually. I haven't quite got used to I haven't given it up yet.
When I talk about him, and I wasn't as close with him as you were, but he was more than an acquaintance. You know, I was 22 when I met him. And he was, when you mention him to people, they get quiet.
Yeah.
Because it's the absence of kind of this heroic centaur angel person who could basically do just about everything.
And yet, suffered so quietly all on his own. And it was so tragic because we were on stage at O2 and I kept calling him because I was directing him, but I said, come for the last night. Cause we had a bit, we wrote into the show. We did Blackmail and we'd bring somebody on in a brown paper bag. And it was a celebrity. And every night somebody came up, Stephen Fry or somebody else, a lot of people came and did it. And I wanted Robin to do the last night. And he said, I can't go on stage. And I said, you don't have to go on stage. Just come and watch us because you're such a Python fan. And then he didn't because he was going to come with Bobcat and then something happened and they didn't. And then the next thing, Eddie Izzard called me from Edinburgh saying he's gone. That was just such a shock.
Mm-hmm.
And terrible.
And they
but he did have this disease.
Yeah, which is, we're finding out more people have it now. It's being diagnosed as that.
But it's the most awful disease because it makes you paranoid. He made him think that his wife was betraying him. Every time she left the room, he was convinced she was betraying him, which is awful with a beautiful young new wife. Mm-hmm. I mean, when he met her, he told me, I found my Tanya, he said to me.
Right.
Which is my wife's name. And
yeah.
I said, anyway.
Well, he was also, for people that know him, Bobcat and Rick Overton, that say that, and his family say that was not him. The person that ended his life was not him, because that's what happens. And I've had that in my life where people I'm close to had a sister with mental health issues. And when meds are changed and when your brain, in his case, was besides that, having the disease that he had.
Undiagnosed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It'll always be a cavern in everybody's heart, especially people that
absolutely
knew him.
And left so many nice kids and so many people who loved him, and it's terrible.
But
on the bright side.
But on the bright side, you're here, and you gifted me by coming over to do this.
Oh.
No, I'm being honest. If you would have told, people always go, if you would have told your 16-year-old, 17-year-old self, honestly, that you were going to be here and I was going to get to talk to you and get to know you, I would have never believed it. And yet you're hopeful about things.
I'm an optimist,
mm-hmm.
especially the mornings. I think I'm an optimist by day and a pessimist at night. But the things I can start the day, but I think that's a boarding school gift. It's so miserable and so horrible. And then the next day may be better. Oh, we'll have a game of football. Or we'll go, creep out the back, see if we find the girls, go over the wall, get some beers. And so we would, it was all about rebellion, really, and escaping from things. So,
but everything, even in Holy Grail, I'm not quite dead yet. And that's a pure optimist. But you're calling up, please, And, don't be a baby.
Oh, I love that line.
Oh, my God.
That's Cleese, I think, at this point. Don't be such a baby.
It's really funny. That is. But that says everything. That just says it all. That's if you're walking in a sick ward and people are really, really dying. And they go, you don't know the pain. Oh, stop complaining. But I'm not dead. Or even in Holy Grail, I just want to sing. Who was that? Saying that, who was the actor?
Terry Jones in the film.
Yes.
Yeah, he was the yes,
the kid. But who was the kid of the king?
Yeah, it was the
and Michael Terry Palin Jones. Was. I never recognized him because of the prosthetic skin wig and the very thin oniony hair. Mm-hmm. I just want to sing.
I want to sing, Father. He's all weedy. It's lovely, Terry. I mean, he's got this white, terrible skin, and it's all blonde hair. But
so
Father,
I had no. I'm an idiot, and I loved him so much. Meaning of life. Everybody only talks about one of the main things they talk about besides, having sex in a sex ed class as a professor is Terry Jones in that giant cavern.
Oh, Mr. Creosote.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And, you know, we won the jury award at Cannes Film Festival.
For Meaning of Life.
And the chairman of the jury was Orson Welles.
Oh my!
And he went.
No
yes,
way.
Absolutely way.
So it was the most self-effacing.
And he
award.
Went to Michael and said that Mr. Creosote scene was the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life.
What a self-aware, unusual thing to hear from a very large man.
Exactly. Well, who else would know how funny that is? But except a very large man who was also a glutton.
Addicted.
Yeah.
And there are 14-year-olds today that are saying wafer thin mint. They exist.
Wafer thin. Yeah.
That is, that comes from a French influence, does it not?
Oui, it's just very, well, because I was the French waiter.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I love that scene because the camera, we finished all that and then Jones is clearing it up and say, woo, you know, he does a little poem and it's terrible. You have to throw vomit over him because he's anti-Semitic. And then I'm the waiter and I take the camera out and we go for a long walk. Mm. I tell you about the meaning of life. And there is a little house, you know, and he's telling you. And he said, the meaning of life is very simple. My mother said, she sat me down. She said, son, be kind to people. Love everybody. And you will be happy. And that is it. Well, fuck you. That's it. I told you, fuck off. And I really like that. I mean, Jonesy gave me that role. He was supposed to do that. He said, I think you'll do this better, Al. Which is really sweet, isn't it?
It's
he did that twice. He did that twice on The Meaning of Life. He gave me the little Protestant wife with Graham, mm-hmm. talking about the, you know, we've had sex twice and we've got two children. Oh, Harold, you know, I'm the little Harold. So I did that one. I thought that's another kindness of Terry. You know, he was a lovely man.
Yeah. I always felt that when I spoke to you about all of the gents, he was
terrific.
One of your special.
Terrific. Yeah, yeah.
Is there any...
the nice ones are dead.
And you're not quite dead yet.
Oh, I'm not nice, though.
You are nice.
No, secretly.
I've seen you. You've never been a prick to me, though. That's the thing.
Wow. Yeah.
What is it? I don't know. I don't get it. Why don't you like me?
Well, you're funny, Bob.
Oh, I love you.
It's hilarious.
Oh, God bless America. Know that?
Yeah.
Yeah, right?
No, yes, for sure. I've lived here.
You're dual citizenship, correct?
No. No.
Traitor.
What do you mean, traitor? You're what?
You're a British citizen.
Alas, yes, but I
wasn't calling you a traitor. I'm saying there are people that would say because you live here.
Yeah, well, I live here because it's wonderful and I love it. And I've been here 26 years,
mm-hmm.
and my wife's American, my child's American, and you know we decided that we'd rather bring up a child in America in California than in another 15 years in rainy London. You know,
right.
So that was what sort of motivated us to come here. But I've loved it, and America saved my life 2 years ago. The clever doctors, brilliantly, and I love America. I'm a very big supporter of it. I'm not blind to things that aren't right, you know, don't work for
right.
me. But it's my privilege to be able to comment on that. But I do love America and Americans. I think they're fantastic.
I love America also. I also love going to England quite a bit. And I do love, you know, you have your house in the south of France, and that's Provence, it's not the
same. Yeah, Provence is lovely.
What's the address?
32 Dibley Gardens, Redditch.
Is that really it?
No.
Dibley Gardens, I was like, how could
Redditch
that?
Redditch is in England.
Oh, yes. Yes, sorry. And Connecticut, because we've stolen everything.
You have a Redditch?
Oh, I thought you said Greenwich. Sorry.
Oh, no.
I have a red itch.
Ooh.
Yeah, because late at night, it's been very...
Pretty mean time with that one, then,
very dry during COVID. That bat cream I got doesn't work. The only other thought I had to ask, because is there one particular... I know the answer is going to be no. Is there one particular movie, television thing, something that you even... Is it Spamalot? Is it one of the films? Is it Meaning of Life? Is it something that you go, this was the most glorious of all of it?
Well, it's a strange life, because obviously when you make a film, you don't think of the film as the entity that people see. You think of it as the experience which you underwent for 8 weeks or so. Mm-hmm. You remember the filming. And so, you know, there were many great high points. I mean, I was. You remember those girls who were pushing Graham off a cliff? They're topless and they're very...
I remember them very well.
I had to spend an afternoon in a dressing room with all of them. And it was raining. And that was kind of hard. But it wasn't the only thing. It was kind of hard. But
Were you single then?
No. Chani was at home. I wasn't, you know, I didn't do anything about it. I wasn't there or anything.
No.
But it was kind of pleasant.
There's nothing to do. I mean, they have no... I've been around that. You can't help it.
It's pleasant. But my, I think the happiest thing I ever was in show business of this stuff was that Mike Nichols had the AFI did a thing for him, honoring him.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end, I had to close the show, and I came on behind Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel, who just sang, you know, all the ones from his film, and I came on in drag, dressed as Emma Thompson in Angels of America, with the four wings and the four wig, and I came out, and I'm looking down. There's Geffen. There's every major person in Hollywood, and I'm going, something's in life or bad. And I went through the audience, and I just thought, I love my life. I love my job. This is so great.
And they were laughing,
they're
right?
All like,
were they laughing?
Oh, yeah. And then I went straight for Emma Thompson, who fell off her chair. She couldn't believe I'm there with the ball, looking like her. Well, not much like her, but certainly in her costume.
Oh, that play of all
things. Angels in America, brilliant.
Oh, my
and
God.
So, and then I went up to Mike, and he was in tears, and it was just... I thought that was a perfect moment for me in life. Sometimes, rarely when you're performing, do you get all the feedback or the pleasure out of it. And
right.
That
would have been like Always Look on the Bright Side of Life done live, because it has the same tone to it. It has it's about the most tragic subject. I mean, you're singing a song in show business way about AIDS. But that's not the context of what it was. You're sending up something for everyone that kind of takes...
Well, it's not about AIDS. I mean, it's just about
Angels
death.
In America is about...
Oh, AIDS. Death. Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, but that, singing Bright Side, they obviously...
You know, no, I didn't mean Bright Side. I meant the Angels in America.
Yes, absolutely. And that...
I don't want people to think that in Life of Brian, that also singing that song had to do with AIDS.
Because
that was the other disaster.
It has to do with death, you know.
Correct.
We have to face death. It's this one thing we have to face. And, you know, I don't find that people who are old actually want that much more. I mean, you know, you get that. I've had enough. I think that's it's an interesting thing for all of us to come to terms with. And,
You're going to say no to this. Do you want to go out on a song? I don't know. How did you get the guitar in your hands?
This may be the last time you see me. This might be the last gig I do. At the end of today, I may just pass away. On the other end, so might you.
Okay, that was Eric Idle. Look, he's gone. He left. But he sang a song at the end. And he's an idol of mine. How could his name be Idol? I just don't get it. It's like your last name's Icon. He is, I don't know. I just love the man. And if you're a Monty Python fan, you must have enjoyed this and gone, Bob, please stop being so ignorant, because that's how I feel about myself when I'm around greatness. So thank you for listening. You can get this book. You should get it. Always Look on the Bright Side of Life, a sort of biography, because it kind of culminates where we're at right now. Look where we're at right now. And to be able to be external from it and go, always look at the bright side of life. How can we do that with what we're living through, what we've lived through these past 2 years, what we lived through 4 years up to that, what we're living through right now, no matter what your viewpoint is, a lot of people ain't happy. So, and ain't is a word you don't hear in Britain too often, but I just, I really look up to this man and I'm honored to have him as a friend. Eric Idle, watch every Monty Python thing ever done. Watch everything Eric Idle ever did. The Ruddles, you want to go through his stuff. If you go and look on Wikipedia, I'm holding up pages for the YouTube people, and you look at his credits, it's like, what? Oh, I know I'm from Casper. You know, things like that, you'll say. Brilliant actor, brilliant writer, brilliant brain, and a really, really good man, Eric Idle. You know what to do with this podcast. You rate, review, you subscribe, and we'll be here. We ain't going anywhere. I'm going to keep doing it because I love doing it. Coming up to 100, but enough about the age of my testicles. How do you say Bob Saget's here for you after that? Well, I said it. Have a good one, everybody. Lots of love.